Hello, and welcome to this pre-recorded session of Millennial 2018. This is the first pre-record I've done, so this is the first recording for Millennial 2018 that I've done, and I'm a wee bit out of practice, a wee bit rusty, as you might expect. But still, I've got a very reliable guest on for this one. It's Greg Johnson of Countercurrents. So, hello, Greg. Welcome to Millennial 2018.
Hey, Woz, it's good to be back.
Oh, thank you for agreeing to take part. So we're going to talk about your 2018, the year that you've had, and I think the first thing to say, because I know that you'll want to get this out there, is that you have a recently published book out just now. Would you like to talk about that?
Yeah, that's the White Nationalist Manifesto. 2018's been a pretty productive year for me. By the end of the year, we'll have put at least a dozen new books to the printers. And the bestseller of the lot, I'm sure, is going to be the White Nationalist Manifesto, which we brought out in September. And I wanted to write a brief encapsulation of a case for white nationalism. And I created a book. It's 138 pages, has 16 very short chapters. It's the kind of book you can really read in an afternoon if you're a fast reader, and if you're a slower reader, you can definitely knock it out in 2 days. And I sort of modeled this on the kinds of books that I loved when I was an undergraduate. I remember getting books in this past master's series that Penguin would put out, and then a lot of these other books like this were published by Oxford University Press. I believe they were short introductory texts on one topic or another. Now there's this vast number of books on Oxford, brief introduction books. And so I thought, I want to do something similarly brief and condensed and accessible for white nationalism. And I hope that this will be the book that most people look at when they want to just get started, get their feet wet, get a sense of what white nationalism is about, what the basic arguments are, and what further reading they might engage in after getting this introduction.
Right. Okay. Would you like to talk about the sort of structure of the book, what each of the chapters is about briefly?
Well, yeah, the book has three parts. There's a part just called White Nationalism, where I lay out the case for why it's morally obligatory. And also politically possible for whites to create ethnically and racially homogeneous homelands or ethno states for ourselves. And the basic argument is from population biology. The main causes of biological extinction, species or subspecies extinction, apply to whites today. We are losing our habitats where we breed. We are being outcompeted by invasive species in our habitats. We are hybridizing with other races of man. And in some places, we're just being subjected to outright predation, outright murder, places like South Africa. So if we don't do something about these problems, within a couple of 100 years, our race will cease to exist. There will be no white people. Whites will cease to exist as a distinct race. That's a problem. It's a problem when it applies to whales, when it applies to tigers, when it applies to all kinds of little creatures that most people don't care about, like snail darters and spotted owls and things like that. And it applies to us. And we are all basically on board with the idea that preserving biodiversity is a good thing. And most white people are willing to pass laws that interfere with their liberty, their economic liberty, especially, in order to preserve biodiversity. And I make the argument that if you're willing to do that for tigers and rhinos, you need to be willing to do that for our own race. And therefore, we need to create white homelands again. We need to put an end to non-white immigration into historical white homelands, and then we need to repatriate recent immigrants. And once we've done this, we'll have recovered control over our own destiny, over our own biological destiny. We'll have recreated breeding spaces for white people, basically nature preserves for white people. And I also argue that the best kind of nature preserves for white people are going to be not just racially homogeneous, but ethnically homogeneous, because the ethnostate is a more natural form of political order than a multicultural state, even if it's just white people. So that's the basic argument of the first part of the book.
See, that's a very interesting topic in itself, to be honest, because I would have quite a lot to say to you about that. But I don't want to interrupt your
flow. Well, no, go ahead. What would you like to... Let's just
Well, it would definitely become a different hanger if we did that. But you see, it seems to me, and I can't really believe that I'm saying this, but it recently has sort of... I've come to the conclusion, okay, conclusion is too strong a word, but it seems to me that the different ethnic groups among the white race are now emerging, and I don't really think it's stoppable. I mean, like, you just used the word multicultural in the context of within the white race, but nobody cares about multicultural stuff within the, like, French and German and Italian. So that, no one calls that multicultural. That's just all white now. And I think that where this used to be the case in America, I think it's now increasingly the case even in Europe, among the young, for sure.
Oh, yeah. I think that's a problem. And I think that needs to be somewhat stopped. I think when we need to put impediments in the way of that. One of the worst things with the young, of course, has been basically the free movement of labor within the European Union. You have lots of young people from poorer countries in the East flocking to cities like London and other parts of the UK or France, looking for better wages. And this is really a demographic problem. A lot of Eastern European countries aren't threatened by immigration. They're primarily threatened by emigration.
Yeah, the brain drain thing.
Yeah, and it's not just the brain drain. It's,
spirit drain, energy drain.
Youth drain. It's really the youth drain. It's not a brain drain when you get Lithuanian girls working as waitresses in London. Being a waitress is demanding, but it's not a brain job, right? It's an honorable job, but it's not a brain job. But what should be happening is young Lithuanian couples should be able to support themselves in their homelands and marry and start families, rather than be off chasing pounds in London until they're almost 30, and then maybe think about coming home. So that's really problematic, I think. I would like to see every European state have basic full employment policies for their own people, and especially for younger people and also talented people. And don't want the brain drain, but
that's what any sensible society would be doing. It always amazes me how this is some kind of block for the individualists and the centrists. They'll start saying, oh, you can't have a powerful state organizing things like this, but you can have a state at least incentivize it. I mean, that's what the whole business of government is about.
Well, we've got a massively powerful state that most of its activities is just fucking things up. I think that we could probably fire half the bureaucrats and actually at the same time put the remaining ones to work improving things. So,
yeah, we already have that situation.
The libertarian attitude is, oh, the government can't accomplish anything. I'm sorry, governments accomplish quite a lot. Governments sent men to the moon. It's only governments that fight great wars, and some of those wars have certainly been necessary. Governments create subways. Governments create educational systems. Governments erect monuments and so forth. Practically everything really great that's been accomplished in European history has been done by governments or within a framework established by governments. So,
sure.
I'm just not these knee-jerk anti-statist statements that come out of people are just ludicrous, and you really just have to laugh at them. We just need to start laughing more at leftists and also at libertarians, because a lot of times they just say stupid stuff and really just laughter is the best commentary.
It's really Spergy, this obsession, you know. I wouldn't name names. There's no point bitching at Christmas, but you know, it does irritate that they're so simplistic, you know.
Yeah.
It's just the state is always bad, and the state can't do anything right, and the state always makes things worse. I mean, come on, for God's sake. Does that even say? It's the kind of thing that you believe when you want to believe. It's necessary to believe that in order to believe something bigger, so you just go for this thing, even though it's obviously fake. It's obviously false. But yeah, it's necessary. So you go for it. You believe it. I think it's just silly. But anyway, to get back to the thing that I really was piqued by, so you think that there is still a viable future for different ethnic groups? The reason, here's the bit of evidence that I always talk about, I always cite for this. I know many nationalists, I know many couples in nationalism and like figureheads in this movement and so on. And I think only one couple, both people are of the same nation. And every other couple I know, the man's from one country and the woman's from a different country. And it's like, if even ethno-nationalists can't be loyal to their own people, and I'm the same as well. I mean, I've done this as well. If even they can't do it, then how can they advocate that everyone else does it? I mean, obviously, well, they're... Yeah. Okay.
You know, it's lonely to be an ethno-nationalist, and there aren't that many females who are into this, and so I think it's very natural that we're going to be a kind of, sad to say, rootless cosmopolitan elite. But the fact of the matter is that first of all, two points to make here. One, if there were more women in the nationalist world, I think you would be finding that people would be settling down with people who are of the same ethnicity, just because you have got more in common.
Yes, yes, that's a definite factor. Yeah.
And I do think that's an important factor. Yes, you have certain things in common because, say, you're a Lithuanian and somebody else is a Polish ethno-nationalist. And Poles and Lithuanians historically haven't gotten along well recently. But because you're really into this nationalist scene, you've got that in common, and there might be romances, right? Okay, fine. But the fact is that romance is going to be on less stable footing than a romance would be between you and a person of your same ethnic group with all the other stuff in common. The more you've got in common, the stronger the relationship. But I do think the tendency is, given that there's a very small number of women in this thing, that they're going to be aggressively pursued by the most desirable and alpha males in the population. And so chances are they're going to end up pairing up with somebody outside their ethnic group. That's going to happen, but I don't think that's necessarily indicative of how things are going to go in the future, especially once the sex ratios become more balanced within the movement. I think people are going to have more options within their own groups, and they're going to find that, yeah, the stronger relationships are the ones between the people that share your native tongue, right? And you're just all the little customs and things that you grow up in common if you belong to the same ethnic group. I do think that I understand what's going on, but I don't necessarily think that's an optimal situation. I think that it's happening for reasons. I think that as the movement becomes bigger, I think less of that will happen. Now, I was just looking at this really remarkable book, which I'm going to write a review of, called National Populism, The Revolt Against Liberal Democracy, by Roger Eatwell and Matthew Goodwin. And this book is written by two leftist academics in England.
Yeah, I've been aware of Matthew Goodwin for ages now. I remember him about 8, maybe 10 years ago in the Telegraph.
Yeah, he tweets, and he's written 5 books, I believe. He's a professor at the University of Kent. And Eatwell is an emeritus professor at Bath, and he's written widely on fascism. I've been aware of his book work for years. Clearly, these people are on the left, but they're anti-liberal leftists. And they look at the liberal cope posting, basically, about the rising tide of national populism, and they're utterly contemptuous of it. And they argue that national populism is not just a reaction to the 2008 economic crisis, that it is a product of deep-seated trends that are not going to go away.
A reaction to globalization.
Well, the things that they talk about, first of all, are the breakdown in trust between the people and the elites, the destruction of ethnicity through globalization, the destruction of comfort and economic security through globalization, and also the breakdown of people's loyalties to the existing parties and the political establishment, which creates a great deal of chaos in the political realm. These trends have been long in their coming, and they're not going to go away anytime soon. And the left that is saying, we'll be through this populism shortly, these old white men just need to die off or something, they're fooling themselves. It's very interesting, the argument. It's extremely encouraging. And one of the things that they do is they go through a lot of empirical studies, the kind of things that political scientists do, and they look at the results. And one of the things that they cite, and I'm trying to find it, I'm flipping around madly in the book, they cite astonishing polls about things like national identity. And
well, that should be interesting, because it sounds like you're about to tell me something very positive about national identity, and I that's surprising to me. Go on.
Okay, I'm trying to find this stuff. I think I know what chapter it's in. Yeah, basically they cite polls about national identity from people in Europe and the United States. And Europeans say that national identity is very important to them. No matter where they are, in the right or the left, they say that their homelands are very important to them, that their national identity is very important to them, and that it's worth preserving. And it's actually worth fighting for, if necessary. The numbers that they cite are in the 80s and 90%. And I thought that was truly astonishing.
I agree.
Okay, here it is. The truth is that many people still feel very committed to their nation state. According to the esteemed World Values Survey, overwhelming majorities of people across the U.S. and Europe say they feel strongly attached to their nation, an average of 81%, see themselves as part of their nation, 93%, and would be willing to fight for their nation, 90%. Now, this is not a partisan thing. This is a poll of all basically voters or just citizens of these countries. Now, that's extremely interesting. Aren't we being told that national identity is increasingly weak and etiolated and disappearing? We're virtually all just on the brink of fusing into one great human race or one great Europe.
Well, I didn't say human race.
I'm talking about the globalists. This is the globaloney.
Yes.
The global.
That's a really good, I've never heard that before.
It's okay. It's an old one. R. Emmett Tyrrell of the American Spectator, I think, was the guy who coined that globaloney, or somebody like that. It's something
that's very good. That's very
from at least the early 80s that I remember. Globaloney. But anyway, that's what they've been saying, that we're on the brink. We're all just about to link our hands together and leap into the void of world oneness and brotherhood. And yet, 82% on average feel very strongly attached to their nation. 93% on average see themselves as part of their nation. And 90% would fight for their nation. That's very high. Those are remarkable numbers. The book is filled with polls like that, data like that, that seems to indicate that the globalist project and the Europeanist project are both basically going to founder on certain facts of reality that they simply have not been able to conjure away through propaganda and high-minded hope. So I think that's very, very interesting. That is something that we can bank on.
Okay. Yeah, it certainly is. As you're speaking, I can't help thinking about this yellow vest thing in France just now, because it does seem to be... See, at first, I couldn't understand how tax hikes could result in this, you know, opprobrium and public disorder. But then I realize it's because the public know that these tax hikes are not necessary at all and are purely, they're being implemented purely for social engineering reasons. So in other words, they're being made to feel like guinea pigs being operated right on by globalists.
Well, so, let's look at Eatwell and Goodwin's basic categories here. They talk about four basic trends. One is distrust. Obviously, that's at work here. The people of France distrust the elites of France, their rulers. Destruction of identity. That's the primary thing they're worried about. Deprivation, loss of Western middle-class living standards. Obviously, these tax hikes are further eroding the French working people and middle-class people's ability to make ends meet. France has the second highest taxation in the world after Denmark, and they're not getting very much for their money. They have an increasingly chaotic and decaying society. You go to Paris and huge chunks of it look like the third world. It's just disgusting how trashed France has become under the last socialist government and now under the stealth socialist rule of Macron. Deprivation. They're worried about losing their first world living standards to globalization. Okay, and the last thing is de-alignment. In the last election in France, the Socialist Party and the main Conservative Party did not have... Neither of them. It's like in the last election in France, it would be like if the Democrats and the Republicans in America did not have candidates in the final runoff. What happened is Macron, who created this movement out of nothing, Bon Marché, I like to call it, it's En Marche, but I just think he's just a cheap globalist sellout, so I call it Bon Marché. But anyway, he was the stealth socialist candidate. The Socialist Party was so unpopular. Hollande was so unpopular that basically the party was finished. And so they took one of the ministers from the government and cast him as a maverick centrist and created this fake movement for him. And then the other person that he went up against in the runoff was Marine Le Pen. Right. So in France, the breakdown of people's alignment between the established right and left parties is almost complete. Right. When the two major parties aren't even in the final runoff for the presidency, that's a sign that the establishment is breaking down. And so what you would expect based on Eatwell and Goodwin's analysis is, yes, there's going to be populist unrest in France. And France has a glorious history of revolutions, of bringing down governments. And I think this could be the beginning of something. It happened in 1968. It happened in the 30s with the right. The fascists in France almost brought down the government in the 1930s. Something similar could be happening today. France has had, five republics? Because republics are very unstable in France. Pluralistic, multi-party democracy is a very bad fit for the French people. Whenever you have these republics, what you end up with is incredibly corrupt and petty-minded, pusillanimous party politics that leads to basically gridlock. And this is why these republics have been overthrown by strongmen again and again and again. So there could be a massive change coming in France. But the point that Eatwell and Goodwin make, though, is that these factors are present in all the major Western European societies, white European societies, that have seen nationalist populism. And they're present in Eastern European societies too.
That's much less surprising for the reasons that are well rehearsed.
Yeah, exactly. But it's a very, very encouraging book. I'm going to write up a complete report on it for Countercurrents and just let people know what a profoundly white-pilling book it is. Now, in terms of our movement, it also has a number of things that we need to take into account and get serious about. One of the things that they argue is that there's nothing undemocratic or fascistic about national populism today. They might be overstating their case there, because I think they're really, this is a somewhat neutral seeming, but I think thinly disguised apologetic for national populism from two people on the left. They're so disgusted with the neoliberal orthodoxy that they're actually creating an apologetic work for national populism, which is generally a movement of the right, to the extent that they're de-emphasizing continuities between this and fascism. They say no, calling it fascist is delusional. These people are soundly democratic. They want more democracy rather than less, and there's some truth to that. But then again, there was a definite populist element to fascist regimes, and also populism goes hand in hand with the strongman. It's often the case that populist regimes will demand that a strong man come in and take on the establishment. And one of the polls they cite, again, was quite astonishing, is that a very high percentage of people agree with the statement that a strong leader is necessary to take power from the establishment and give it back to the people.
Well, I mean, obviously Salvini in Italy would seem to be heading in that direction. I know he's not even the prime minister. I think he's the equivalent of the Home Secretary. But he is obviously sort of slipping into that role.
Yeah, yeah. And as far as their conclusions go, they don't think that national populism is going to go away. They think that basically the entire political establishment is just going to absorb national populist ideas. Which basically means it's a sea change and that globalization is over. That globalization is not going to be the dominant paradigm, and that neoliberalism, which goes hand in hand with globalization, is not going to be the dominant paradigm in politics in the future. Now, that is a wave that we can surf. The cover of the book has a picture of a wave on it. This is the wave of the future. I think that our movement needs to think very, very carefully in terms of how we can best align ourselves with the existing features of national populism and ride that into power in the future, because we do want to influence the future. That is the route that we are going to take to restoring the biological integrity of our race and the integrity of our different homelands as well, preserving our different nations and nation states.
So you think that I'm unnecessarily black-pilled about the future of separate European ethnic groups?
I think you're unnecessarily black-pilled. There are always people in these ethnic groups who are less attached to their ethnic group than they are to something like an ideology or a religion or a particular person, and they will marry out. We've always had that in our history.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I use that nationalist couples as an obvious sort of example. But I would say more broadly than that, in looking beyond the dissident right to people in general, I think there is a hell of a lot of, ethno-mixing going on that certainly wasn't happening
even 30 years ago. Part of that has to do with the EU. And free movement of labor and things like that. That can change. I think that should change. But the point is that every ethnic group in Europe is basically sloughing off its least ethnocentric members through this process, which means that the people who are left are going to tend to be more ethnocentric. And therefore, you're going to find that Poles who marry Poles when they have lots of other options are going to be people with a stronger sense of ethnicity than the Poles who marry out, for instance. And so there is a self-reinforcing quality to ethnic identity.
Well, it's like how conservatives have more kids than liberals. So mm-hmm. even though liberals do a lot of damage, they also sort of remove themselves from the gene pool in the meantime. So yeah. it's and almost like a self...
The people who marry out will marry out, but the people who are left will be less susceptible to that. And so in the long run, if susceptibility to these things is in part just inheritable, and it is in part just heritable, you're going to find that there'll be less and less of that in the future. And also, because inherited preferences can be expressed in political institutions as laws, what you're going to find is, you know, in a generation or so, the Poles who marry Poles and stay home are going to be the ones making laws and imposing their preferences on other Poles who might be less, ethnocentric, but they're going to end up going along with it anyway, right? And so I think there, you know, in 50 years, chances are there will be stronger ethnic differences amongst European states. So yeah, I don't despair of that at all. I don't think it's a huge problem that some people marry out, because I don't think that it's something that will continue to the point where there are no distinct groups. In fact, I think the marrying out of some people causes the ethnic identity of those who don't marry out to actually be stronger.
Mm. Okay, that's a very interesting perspective. Sorry, have you said all you wanted to say about that?
Yeah. I was just going to go back to the manifesto.
Yes, that's what I was about
plugging the manifesto here. Yeah. Okay. The second part of the manifesto basically deals with some basic concepts. And so I deal with supremacism. And I talk about why, you know, we're not supremacists in what sense we are not white supremacists. I talk about diversity and why diversity is a problem. I give an analysis of the concept of homogeneity and talk about the forms in which we can create more homogeneous societies. I talk about the ethnostate as a concept. And I also talk about the concept of whiteness. I talk about why it's really a necessary concept for us to discuss, that we can't just talk about Polish nationalism or Hungarian nationalism. We have to talk about whiteness. And the way I define white nationalism in the book, it's not nationalism for generic white people, because there aren't any. I mean, all white people basically belong to one ethnic group or another.
So what then is whiteness?
Well, whiteness is a racial category, and it's a necessary condition of European identity. And so the way I define white nationalism is that we stand for the ethnic self-determination, the ethnic sovereignty of all white peoples. So it's not the sovereignty of the, basically the generic white person. It's the sovereignty of all the different white peoples that we stand for. So we look upon Americans as a distinct people. We look upon Canadians as a distinct people, even in the colonies, where you've had these melting pot societies, where you've had people from different old world ethnicities come and fuse together. The result has not been a generic white person. It's been a lot of different new white peoples. Because if they were all the same, there'd be no difference between Americans and Canadians. And there are some differences. Half my family is Canadian, and I spent a lot of time in Canada, and the fact is that Canadians are somewhat different than Americans. So the generic white person is not a thing. White people come in different ethnic groups, and we stand for the right of self-determination for all these different white ethnic groups, because those are natural political units. And if you want to create white homelands, you try and create white homelands along the natural political joints that exist in the world. And those are ethnic groups. And so when we talk about rights, though, this is an important concept. A right is not an obligation. You might have the right to a homeland if you are a particular ethnic group. But say, you know, like the Germans in Switzerland, you're perfectly content living in the Swiss Federation. Your Germanness is not being contravened in the least. You feel very comfortable there. The Swiss Germans aren't going to exercise their right to an ethnostate. But if they felt that their identity was sufficiently threatened by the Swiss Federation, then they would have a right. And if you choose to exercise your rights, nobody else in the world has the right to get in your way. So that's the sense in which I talk about a right to self-determination. It's not an obligation. If you don't want it, you know, we're not going to force it upon you. But if there are peoples, stateless peoples, who are yearning to have their own autonomy, then the rest of the world should say, okay, we stand behind your right. We recognize your right. We're going to help in the most peaceful and orderly way possible realize this right, because this is how we conceive of the road to having a better world, a world where we don't have unnecessary ethnic conflicts.
Sorry about that. That is, it sounds like you've distilled an awful lot of thought and thinking into this. I mean, it seems like it's almost everything is in this. Everything is in here. Is that, I mean, obviously, is that what you intended?
Oh, yeah. I want this to be comprehensive, so I deal with a lot of issues. I can't deal with every issue, but I deal with a lot of essential issues. I wanted it to be simple and compelling, so I worked to make this very, very readable. And in fact, there are these online readability calculators.
Oh, the Flesch Kincaid test and all that.
Yeah, there are these computer programs that will test your readability. So I found a website. Actually, Aidan Cassiel found it for me. And if you plug your text into it, it will use these various computations of readability, like six of them, and spit out the results. And so it turned out. What's that?
That's just amazing that there's a website that can do that. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
Oh, yeah. It's very, very useful. And so I put the each chapter in, and I found that the first chapter started out at an eighth grade reading level, and then it sort of rose to 11th grade, and that the average reading level for the whole book after the opening of the first chapter came to about an 11th grade reading level, reading comprehension level, you know, based on the American school system. And I thought, well, that's pretty darn good. I want this to be readable by people with a high school education, bright teenagers, adults who went to high school and so forth that didn't go on to college. That's one of the things that Eatwell and Goodwin talk about. One of the most powerful predictive factors for being a shitlib or being a national populist is whether or not you went to college. And honestly, I think that we should do everything in our power to destroy college education.
This is, of course, people will say that, and it has been said that liberals are more intelligent, they're more educated at any rate than conservatives.
They're more educated, it's but because they're not necessarily more intelligent.
Yeah. Well, yeah, exactly. They get indoctrinated with liberalism at university. It's happening the other way around.
Yeah. And there is this kind of uncanny valley of being above average in IQ, but that just goes along with being incredibly vain. Usually you get this vanity of being, I'm an educated person. And they come up with this incredible nonsense.
Don't get me started.
Yeah.
I've been fighting this for years, and so have you, of course.
It's this smug, college-educated, middle-brow attitude that they're the smart and educated ones, and their heads are full of rubbish. You have to get, you know, above 120 IQ before you have any hope of thinking your way out through the other side of all this college indoctrination. Or, if you never went to college, you sort of skip that. I mean, you get it from the general culture, but you don't get it so intensely, and you don't put so much of your time and invest so much of your time and ego into being indoctrinated this way. And so you're less likely to be fooled. But I'm starting to think that the education bubble in America bursting might be a great thing. College educations have become enormously expensive, and there's a vast amount of student debt. And they're talking about the next economic crisis being the bursting of the student debt bubble. If the bursting of the student debt bubble causes an economic downturn, fine. You know, if it causes fewer people to go to college in the future, that's going to be a good thing. Because most people, you know, go to college and, you know, they get college degrees in useless stuff anyway at great expense. And it messes their minds up and makes them bad people generally. So the fewer people who go to college, the more likely they are to actually resonate with national populist messages. And that would be a good thing for us.
Oh, absolutely. It is hilarious. The thing about the educated smug liberal, you know, in the first 2 years of my channel, I did a series called The Smugness of Ex-Liberal. Each one was a different type of liberal. But one of the most common things was this, and you hear it all the time. They have this assumption that they are more educated than whoever it is that's disagreeing with them. And of course, I think that's they're encouraged to think like that. That is sort of instilled in them. But one thing you said, it was interesting, because if people had careers and actual skills and so on, then they would place much less emphasis or value on their education as a means of their as a source of their identity. In other words, they'd be able to, they wouldn't need to rely on their being educated in order to think that they're a good person.
Right.
Because I think the modern liberal does. And so they stake everything on having the opinions that were inculcated by that lecturer, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago.
Yeah, exactly. It really is a huge status thing. And if we can get those middle brow people, you know, basically what it is that being college educated is one of those things that used to be an elite thing, right?
Oh, yeah. Wonderful.
1 or 2% maybe of the populace. And now what are we getting? 40-50% of the populace now are expected to go to college. So it had this elite cachet, but then it's been democratized, but it still retains some elements of that cachet. And but it's become this ghastly fake middle brow pretentiousness. If we can,
and there's also cruelty in it as well, though, because it encourages. And I don't want to sound like a complete cold-hearted elitist here, but it encourages not brighter than average, but not very bright people to think that they are very bright.
Oh yeah,
and then there's that nothing. Leaves them. Then they have to deal with the cognitive dissonance that is created by that delusion.
Yeah, it inculcates the Dunning-Kruger effect into vast numbers of people.
Exactly,
they're not as smart as they think they are. They're not as educated as they think they are. And it gives them a status symbol that they can use to suck up and shit down. It makes them nasty people. And in a nasty, greased pole, you know, struggle for status. It's almost nothing but that. Social signaling, liberal signaling, it's all just a game of incredibly insecure, up-jumped middle-class or lower-class people scrabbling for status. And we just need to mock it.
It's a recipe for disaster.
Excuse me. We just need to mock these people. I mean, they are ludicrous. They're the worst kinds of snobs. You know, there's all this great...
Yes, indeed. I have to say, your camera has switched on. I think it's showing the wall or something. Might want to deactivate that.
Well, sorry about that. Yeah. Yeah, okay. Yeah, I don't know what happened there. Yeah, they're just the worst kinds of snobs. There's all this great comic literature making fun of snobs. And we need to mobilize some of those comic tropes to make fun of these empty-headed, middle-brow, middle-class, college-educated.
Well, I mean, I would say that's what the NPC meme has largely been about. Really showing these people, like, okay, you are brighter than average, but you're really nothing special. You know, you get your opinions from off the shelf, really.
Yeah, exactly. I think that the NPC thing was profoundly upsetting. Years and years ago, when I was living in Washington, D.C., I went into this the store. It was called Second Story Books. It was a used bookstore. And there was a guy at the counter wearing a little button that said, "I think, therefore I'm dangerous." And I said to him
it's just such posing.
Yeah, I know. After I had gotten my book and my change and the receipt from him, I said, "You know, you only think you think, and that makes you really dangerous." He didn't even know what I meant because, he was just a pretentious, up-jumped, middle-class, over-educated snob. But that's really true. They only think they think, and that's what makes them really dangerous. And the NPC meme was so good because it really got to these people, because it undermined their claim to status and their idea that it's all those other people out there who didn't go to college who are the blank-faced, mind-numbed robots, the sheep. When in fact, they're the sheep.
Yeah, absolutely. You see this all the time. And I used to get driven to distraction debating these idiots on Facebook a long time ago, like 2012, 2013, 2011. It was a nightmare. It was awful. I actually started making a series about it, and it was so grueling and depressing that I could only make two episodes of it. Because it was just so awful, like the learned nihilism that they espouse, which is so concentrated. They can think of an answer for everything. They can calculate an answer for everything. Of course, it's not the same thing. And
they always come up with something. Yeah. Yeah.
But they seem to understand nothing.
Oh, yeah. It's so depressing. Yeah. But the fewer people like this being spewed out of these education factories, the better. And if the college bubble bursts, the fact is that college education might not be possible for huge numbers of people. And that might be a very, very good thing.
I think it would be. I also think it's inevitable. I think it's going to happen whether it's a good thing or not, because it just cannot be sustained. It's running on debt, massive amounts of debt, and it's not conducive to a healthy lifestyle, a good starting life. You start with $50,000 of debt or whatever it is now. That's just crazy. And I also think that with the internet, with online learning, it's just increasingly pointless. And as for the social side of going to university, you can get that elsewhere anyway, so it doesn't matter. It just seems to be something that is heading towards its end of life. And as you say, it has this cachet from the past of a very elitist, cozy sort of institution and environment. But increasingly, no one gets that at university now. No. So it's a phantom, really. Mm-hmm. But anyway, to get back to, had you finished speaking about the manifesto?
Well, there's a final section on how to create a movement. And there I talk about the distinction between politics and metapolitics. I talk about the concept of cultural hegemony. I talk about the new right versus the old right. I talk about an ethos that we can create and cultivate in the movement that will allow it to sort of grow from the bottom up and become, a vital, non-hierarchical network, political, metapolitical network that can basically change the way people think. And I end with some thoughts about why I think white nationalism is inevitable. I think white identity politics is inevitable. It's already happening.
I agree. I agree with that. You know, it does seem to be that people on the left increasingly, like not a huge number of them yet, but it's starting to happen. As you said, like Matthew Goodwin, for example, they're starting to see that, well, okay, if we've advocated identity politics for everyone else, then to be fair, we have to advocate it for white people. And whether we do that or not, they're going to do it. White people are going to react to mass immigration, multiculturalism, globalization, mm-hmm. and the erasure of their identities, and the whole attack, the vicious, ongoing, relentless attack on their identity. They're going to react to that with white identity politics. So mm-hmm. there's an inevitability to it. I completely agree.
Yeah. Yeah. And so what we need to do is we need to work to break down the taboo against white identity politics. That taboo is the thing that unites the whole political establishment, left, right, and center, against us right now. Even the conservatives, even the alt-right, the thing that they have in common with the far left is the impermissibility, the tabooed nature of white identity politics. Once that taboo is broken down, everything will change. And I think that taboo is breaking down. So white identity politics is inevitable. It's necessary if we're going to survive. And I think more and more people recognize its necessity. And it's also moral. I think one can make a very strong case that there's nothing immoral about whites taking their own side in a conflict. And so I'm very, very optimistic. In the long term, things are very bad. If we don't change things, we're going to become extinct as a people. In the medium term, I'm very optimistic because, as Eatwell and Goodwin have very strongly argued, there are a lot of factors that are conspiring to give us an opportunity to turn this all around. For a long time, I've been saying that the main thing driving white identity politics is not the efforts of people like you and me. It's the breakdown of the existing system. It's the consequences of multiculturalism. And they basically agree with that, and they even add to it, and they deepen that analysis. And so I'm very, very indebted. Distrust in the establishment. I mean, we've seen that. Destruction of identity, that is one element. The loss of first world living standards to globalization. Again, I've emphasized that. The breakdown in alignment with the existing political establishment. That is an important factor that, you know, I was sort of accepting that that was going to happen. But I didn't really just sort of take stock of what a powerful long-term trend this is and how it's been accelerating tremendously in the last 5 years or so. So there are just a lot of factors here that I think in the medium term give me a lot of hope that we can get things together and change things. Now, in the short run, what do we do? Well, 2018 for this movement has basically been a year of waiting.
Yes.
In the white nationalist world, I mean, 2017 was a disaster for the most part. We just went from one disaster to another. 2018, at the beginning of the year, we had the internet blood sports stuff, and that was giving us some hope that, okay, maybe something new would happen. We had some great memes. We had It's Okay to Be White and the NPC meme. They both were viral. They were very powerful. They were giving us a sense that, yeah, this old kind of mimetic warfare stuff, it still happens. We suffered a huge amount in terms of deplatforming, really starting after Charlottesville, but it's just kept getting worse and worse throughout 2018. And I think a lot of people are just kind of exhausted, and they're kind of unplugged, and they're just waiting. They're waiting for a way forward. They're waiting for something new.
I don't want to open a massive new topic this late in the hangout, but do you think that Trump's 2020 campaign could be that thing?
Trump's 2020 campaign could be that thing, but I don't think that in 2020 we are going to be as enamored of Trump as we were in 2016. Already at this midterm, you know, the glamour was gone, basically. We were rooting for him in certain ways, and we were glad to see the old Trump campaigner. Trump was a better campaigner than he was a president, unfortunately.
Yes.
And the hope that we had that Trump would be the guy who would save America, well, I think that hope is basically gone. Trump is not going to save America. The people who said maybe it would be best for Hillary, she would be the accelerationist candidate. It turns out Trump was the accelerationist candidate. He has caused the left to go completely insane. They're far more crazy now than they would have been if Hillary Clinton were in charge. But it's good that they're crazy, because that craziness is real. It's better that they act openly insane rather than try and keep it together so that they can enjoy power and really fuck us for the long run. So I think that they've done a lot of damage to themselves during Trump's administration. And I think that there is a level of polarization in America that I have never seen in my lifetime. I don't think this country has been so polarized since the Civil War.
It's not just America. I mean, I understand why you want to speak about America, but I think it's everywhere. I think the polarization between the left, well, what we would knee-jerkly call the left and the right, that polarization is I've never seen it like this. I don't think anyone has.
No, and Trump really has accelerated it. I think even for Europeans, he's accelerated it. And I think that's a very, very good thing. I don't know what's going to happen in the near future in the United States. My feeling is that the Democrats have broken democracy, and that we're going to start seeing a time when people basically say, look, you know, democracy is rule of the people. But I think increasing numbers of sensible white Americans are coming to realize that the people who vote for the Democratic Party are not the same people. They're not us. They're not our people. They're a coalition of every other racial group, plus insane liberals and, just degenerates, basically. They're not us. And I don't think people are going to play the game of civility and the peaceful transfer of power after elections anymore. And what's happening in France today could be happening in the United States in 2020. At this point, a lot of white Americans are basically saying, I'm sorry, I don't care what happens in the ballot box. We don't trust the ballot box anymore. We know illegals are voting. We know that the Democrats just steal elections. Why are we going along with this anymore? And they do not want to be ruled by these psychotic grifters and race hustlers anymore. And there will come a time when I think Trump winning in 2020 might be less good for us than Trump losing in 2020. I think if Trump lost in 2020, we could have Paris-style or French-style insurrections. Not because we love him so much, but because we know that they're totally corrupt, and we can basically bet now that, first of all, they'll steal the election in all kinds of obvious ways, but second, multiculturalism and immigration delegitimizes democracy. The whole point of flooding our countries with non-whites has been a leftist tool to suppress the white vote. It is a giant voter suppression operation. Therefore, these elections are no longer legitimate. None of these elections are legitimate anymore. And the more Americans who accept this, the more civil unrest there's going to be. And I think that we're reaching the breaking point for a lot of Americans. I'm going to be watching very, very with great interest what happens in France. And I'm going to be especially interested in finding out the fine-grained organizational structure of these riots.
That's a bit of a mystery. That's a bit of a mystery at the moment, isn't it?
Yeah. But I think a lot of this is going to come across the Atlantic in a couple of years. I think a lot of things are going to change.
Okay. All right. Well, oh, my camera has just switched off, run out of batteries. So that seems like an appropriate time to close this Hangout. Hold on a second. I'll just return to my avatar. All right. Well, Greg Johnson, we did start saying that we were going to talk about 2018. That's kind of happened by the by. But in the end, we have talked about the manifesto. I hope this has been a sufficient introduction to it for anyone who didn't already know about it. Okay. Is there anything else you'd like to say in closing?
Yeah. You can buy the manifesto at amazon.com or .de or .co.uk or .fr. And you can buy it at counter-currents.com. It's been selling quite well. It's been reviewed at the Occidental Observer and American Renaissance at the Z blog. And I hope that more reviews of it will appear in time. I have gotten a lot of good feedback. No one's found any big holes in my argument yet, thank goodness. So read it. It's filled with useful arguments, some of them quite original, actually. I'm quite pleased with that.
Right. Well done. Congratulations.
Yeah.
And I mean that.
Yeah. And 2018, to get back to 2018, 2018 will be the year of the White Nationalist Manifesto and practically nothing else, I'm afraid, for the American movement. It's been pretty dead. Been pretty dead over on this side of the pond, I'm afraid. You've got a sense of that. You know, people are just, I don't know, they're waiting for something new. And, well,
it is a very difficult time to characterize, for sure. But as you say, I mean, I think people are basically waiting for a new direction. So, but it will certainly come. I've never lost faith in that.
Oh, yeah. Read the White Nationalist Manifesto for the arguments and read National Populism by Eatwell and Goodwin for a sense of the great wave of long-term political trends that is going to crest and bring white nationalism to fruition in Europe and America in some form or another in the next few decades. I am very, very optimistic. So, yeah, 2018's been a holding pattern for a lot of people. It's been a very active time for me. I hope in 2028, people look back on 2018 and say, yeah, that was the year of the White Nationalist Manifesto and precious little else.
Okay. All right, then. Well, Greg Johnson, thank you very much. I hope you've enjoyed this this chat.
I have, yeah. Thanks so much for having me on.
Excellent. I will say, I apologize if I've been a bit unresponsive, but I am a bit ill still, a bit of a head cold, and I'm also very tired because I've been renovating this room today in preparation for filming Millennial.
So, clean your room, bucko. Yes.
Yes. I know there's some validity to it, but let's not get into that now.
Yeah.
All right. Okay.
Well, Merry Christmas, everyone.
Yes. Merry Christmas, everyone. And thank you, Greg.